Welcome to this uvula audio presentation of the Confessions of St. Augustine, Volume 7, Book 8, 1. My God, let me be thankful as I remember and acknowledge all your mercies. Let my whole self be steeped in love of you, and all my being cry, Lord, there is none like you. You have broken the chains that bound me. I will sacrifice in your honor. I shall tell how it was that you broke them, and when they hear what I have to tell, all who adore you will exclaim, Blessed be the Lord of heaven and earth. Great and wonderful is his name. The words of your scriptures were planted firmly in my heart, and on all sides you were there like a rampart to defend me. Of your eternal life I was certain, although I had only seen it like a confused reflection in a mirror. And I had now been rid of all my doubts about an incorruptible substance from which all other substances take its being. I did not ask for a more certain proof of you, but only to be made more steadfast in you. But in my worldly life all was confusion. My heart had still to be rid of the leaven which remained over. I should have been glad to follow the right road, to follow our Savior himself, but still I could not make up my mind to venture along that narrow path. By your inspiration, it seemed to me a good plan to go and see Simplicianus, who, as I could see for myself, was a good servant of yours. The light of your grace plainly shone on him, and besides, I had been told that from boyhood he had always led a most devout life. By now he was an old man, and I thought that in all the long years he had spent to such good purpose in following your way, he must have gained great experience and much knowledge, as indeed he had. I hoped that if I put my problems to him, he would draw upon his experience and his knowledge to show me how best a man in my state of mind might walk upon your way. I saw that the church was full, yet its members each followed a different path in the world. But my own life in the world was unhappy. It was a heavy burden to me, because the hope of honor and wealth was no longer as before a spur to my ambition, enabling me to bear so onerous a life devoted to their service. Such things now held no attractions for me in comparison with your sweetness and my love of the house where you dwell, the shrine of your glory. But now I was still held firm in the bonds of woman's love. Your apostle did not forbid me to marry, although he counseled a better state, wishing earnestly that all men should be as he was himself. But I was a weaker man and was tempted to choose an easier course, and this reason alone prevented me from reaching a decision upon my other problems. I was listless, exhausted by the canker of anxiety, because there were other reasons, too, why I found it irksome to be forced to adapt myself to living with a wife, as I was pledged to do. The voice of truth had told me that there are some who have made themselves eunuchs for love of the kingdom of heaven. But he also said, Let only those who take this in, whose hearts are large enough for it. What folly it argues in man's nature, this ignorance of God, so much good seen, and he who is existent good not known. But in this sense I was no longer a victim of such folly. I had overcome it, and from the evidence of all creation I had found you, our Creator, and your Word who is God with you, one God with you, by whom you created all things. But there are godless men of another kind, those who have no knowledge of God, but do not honor him or give thanks to him as God. I had fallen into this error also, but your right hand supported me. You rescued me and set me where I might recover the health of my soul. For you have told man that wisdom is fearing the Lord, and you have warned him, Do not give yourself airs of wisdom, for they who claim to be so wise turn fools. I had already found the pearl of great value, and I ought to have sold all that I had and bought it. But I still held back. 2. So I went to Simplicianus, the spiritual father of Ambrose, who was now a bishop. Ambrose truly loved him like a father, for it was through him that he had received your grace. I told him how I had drifted from error to error, and when I mentioned that I had read some of the books of the Platonists translated into Latin by Victorinus, who had once been professor of rhetoric at Rome, and, so I had been told, had died a Christian, Simplicianus said that he was glad that I had not stumbled upon the writings of other philosophers that were full of fallacies and misrepresentations drawn from worldly principles. In the Platonists, he said, God and his word are constantly implied. Then, to encourage me to follow Christ's example of humility, which is hidden from the wise and revealed to little children, he told me about Victorinus, whom he had known intimately when he was in Rome. I shall repeat the story here because it shows the great glory of your grace, and for your glory I must tell it. Victorinus was an old man of great learning, with a profound knowledge of all the liberal sciences. He had studied a great many books of philosophy, and published criticisms of them. He had been master to many distinguished members of the Senate, and to mark his outstanding ability as a teacher, he had even been awarded a statue in the Roman Forum, a great honor in the eyes of the world. He had always been a worshipper of idols, and had taken part in sacrilegious rites that were then in vogue amongst most of the nobility of Rome. Rome, in fact, had become the suppliant of the gods whom she had once defeated, for her leaders now talked only of prodigies, monstrous deities of every sort, and Anubis who barked like a dog. All the gods who had once battled against Neptune, Venus, and Minerva. For many years, Victorinus, now an old man, had never ceased to defend these practices with all the fire of his oratory. And yet he was not ashamed to be the child of Christ and to become an infant at your font, submitting his neck to the yoke of humility and bowing his head before the ignominy of the cross. O Lord, Lord, who bade heaven stoop and come down to earth, at whose touch the mountains were wreathed in smoke, how did you find the way to his heart? He read the Holy Scriptures, so Simplicianus told me, and made the most painstaking and careful study of all Christian literature. Privately, as between friends, though never in public, he used to say to Simplicianus, I want you to know that I am now a Christian. Simplicianus used to say, I shall not believe it or count you as a Christian until I see you in a church of Christ. At this, Victorinus would laugh and say, Is it then the walls of the church that make the Christian? He often repeated his claim to be a Christian, and each time Simplicianus gave him the same answer, only to receive the same rejoinder about the walls. He was afraid of offending his proud friends who worshipped heathen gods, and he thought that a storm of hostility would break upon him from the peak of their Babylonian dignity, as though it were from the cedars of Lebanon that the Lord had not yet brought down. But later on, as a result of his attentive reading, he became resolute. He was seized by the fear that Christ might deny him before the holy angels if he was too faint-hearted to actually acknowledge Christ before men. And he felt himself guilty of a great crime in being ashamed of the sacraments instituted by your word in his lowly estate, whereas he was not ashamed of the impious rites devoted to those proud deities whom his own pride had led him to follow and accept. So he repudiated vanity and turned in shame to the truth. Simplicianus told me that quite unexpectedly and without warning he said, Let us go to the church. I want to be made a Christian. So Simplicianus, unable to contain his joy, went with him to the church. He was instructed in the first mysteries of the faith, and soon afterwards, to the wonder of Rome and the joy of the church, he gave in his name to be reborn through baptism. Ungodly men were ill content to see it. Vainly they gnashed their teeth in envy. But happy was the man whose trust was there bestowed, who shunned the rites of strange gods, the lure of lies. Eventually, the time came for making his profession of faith. At Rome, those who are about to enter into your grace usually make their profession in a set form of words that they learn by heart and recite from a raised platform in view of the faithful. But Simplicianus said that the priests offered to allow Victorinus to make his profession in private, as they often did for people who seemed likely to find the ceremony embarrassing. But Victorinus preferred to declare his salvation in full sight of the assembled faithful, for there was no salvation in the rhetoric that he taught, and yet he had professed it in public. If he was not afraid of uttering his own words before a crowd of madmen, why should he be frightened to name your word before a meek flock? So when he mounted the platform to make his profession, all who knew him joyfully whispered his name to their neighbors. There can be none who did not know him, and the hushed voices of the whole exultant congregation joined in the murmur, "Victorinus! Victorinus!" They were quick to let their joy be heard when they saw him, but just as quickly came to a hush as they waited to hear him speak. He made his declaration of true faith with splendid confidence, and all would gladly have seized him in their arms and clutched him to their hearts. But it was with the arms of love and joy that they seized him and made him their own. 3. O God, who are so good, what is it that makes men rejoice more for the salvation of a soul for which all had despaired, or one that is delivered from great danger, than for one for which hope has never been lost, or one which has been in less peril? You too, merciful Father, rejoice more over one sinner who repents than over 99 souls that are justified and have no need of repentance. We also are overjoyed when we hear that the sheep that is lost is carried home on the happy shepherd's shoulders, and that the coin is returned to your treasury, while the neighbors rejoice with the woman who found it. The joy of Mass in your church moves us to tears when we hear the gospel that tells us how the younger son died and returned to life, and how he was lost and found again. You rejoice in us and in your angels, who are sanctified by holy charity. For you are always the same, because all those things that are neither unchangeable nor endure forever are known forever to you, and your knowledge of them is unchangeable. What is it then that makes the soul rejoice more over things that it finds or regains than it would if it had always had them? There's proof of this in worldly things as well, and the evidence that proclaims the truth of it is all around us. The victorious general marches home in triumph, but there would have been no victory if he had not fought. And the greater the danger in the battle, the greater the joy of the triumph. Sailors are tossed in a storm that threatens to wreck their ship. They are terror-stricken at the thought of impending death. But when the sky clears and the sea is calmed, their fear gives place to joy no less profound. One whom we love is ill. His pulse tells us he's in danger, and all who long for him to get well suffer in sympathy. But once he is on the road to recovery, even though he has not yet the strength to walk as he used to, we are happier at this than we were before, when he was quite well and could walk without effort. Men even procure for themselves the pleasures of this life by means of pain, not unexpected pain that comes upon them uninvited, but pain that they deliberately induce for themselves. There is no pleasure in eating and drinking unless it is preceded by the discomfort of hunger and thirst. Drunkards eat salty things to make their throats dry and painful, so that they may enjoy the pleasure of quenching their thirst. It is customary, too, for girls who are engaged to be married to delay the wedding for fear that a husband who has not suffered the trials of a long courtship may think his bride too cheaply won. If this is true of mean and reprehensible forms of pleasure, it is equally true of those that are legitimate and permissible. It can be seen in friendship of the purest and most honorable kind, and it was true of the younger son who died and returned to life, who was lost and found again. It is always the case that the greater the joy, the greater is the pain that precedes it. Why should this be, O Lord my God, when you are your own eternal joy? You are joy itself, and you are always surrounded by creatures who rejoice in you. Why is it that in this part of your creation that we know there is ebb and flow of progress and retreat, of hurt and reconciliation? Is this the rhythm of our world? Is this what you prescribed when from the heights of heaven and to the depths of earth, from the first beginnings to the end of time, from the angel to the worm, from the first movement to the last, you allotted a proper place and a proper time to good things of every kind, and to all your just works? How can I hope to understand the height and depth of you, from the greatest to the most lowly of your works? You never depart from us, yet it is hard for us to return to you. 4. Come, O Lord, and stir our hearts. Call us back to yourself. Kindle your fire in us and carry us away. Let us scent your fragrance and taste your sweetness. Let us love you and hasten to your side. Are there not many who return to you from a deeper pit of darkness than Victorinus? They come to you and their darkness grows bright when they accept the light by which all who accept it are empowered to become the children of God. But if they are less famous than Victorinus, there is less rejoicing, even among those who know them. For when large numbers of people share their joy in common, the happiness of each is greater, because each adds fuel to the other's flame. Moreover, when converts are well known, their example guides many others to salvation. Where they lead, many are sure to follow, and this is why those who already have faith are delighted at their conversion, because their joy is not reserved for the famous alone. It would be unthinkable that men of wealth and power should be more welcome in your church than those who are poor and unknown, for you have chosen what the world holds weak, so as to abash the strong. You have chosen what the world holds base and contemptible. Nay, you have chosen what is nothing, so as to bring to nothing what is now in being. It was through the Apostle Paul that you spoke these words, and he too, the least of the apostles, chose to change his name from Saul to Paul, to mark the great victory, when Sergius Paulus, the proconsul, his pride laid low by the apostles' bold words, submitted to the gentle yoke of Christ and became a subject of the great king. For the firmer our enemy the devil holds a man in his power, and the greater the number of others whom he holds captive through this man, the greater the victory when he is won back. The devil has a firmer hold on men in high places because of their pride and their rank, and through them he keeps hold on many more because of the influence they wield. So the more your children prize the heart of Victorinus, which had been an impregnable stronghold of the devil, and his tongue, which Satan had used as a sharp and powerful weapon to slay so many men, the more abundant, and rightly so, was their joy when they saw that our king had made the strong man his prisoner. They saw his profession taken from him and cleansed, so that he was proved the object of his Lord's regard, hallowed and serviceable, and fit for all honorable employment. 5. When your servant Simplicianus told me the story of Victorinus, I began to glow with fervor to imitate him. This, of course, was why Simplicianus had told it to me. He went on to say that under the Emperor Julian, a law had been passed to prohibit Christians from teaching literature and rhetoric. Victorinus had obeyed the law, preferring to give up his own school of words rather than desert your word, by which you make the lips of infants vocal with praise. In this he seemed to me not so much courageous as fortunate, because in this way he found the means of devoting himself entirely to you. I longed to do the same, but I was held fast, not in fetters clamped upon me by others, but by my own will, which had the strength of iron chains. The enemy held my will in his power, and from it he had made a chain and shackled me, for my will was perverse, and lust had grown from it. And when I gave in to lust, habit was born, and when I did not resist the habit, it became necessity. These were the links that together formed what I have called my chain, and it held me fast in the duress of servitude. But the new will that had come to life in me had made me wish to serve you freely and enjoy you, my God, who are our only certain joy, was not yet strong enough to overcome the old, hardened as it was by the passage of time. So these two wills within me, one old and one new, one the servant of the flesh and the other of the spirit, were in conflict, and between them they tore my soul apart. From my own experience, I now understood what I had read, that the impulses of nature and the impulses of the spirit are at war with one another. And in this warfare, I was on both sides. But I took the part of that which I approved in myself, rather than the part of that which I disapproved. For my true self was no longer on the side of which I disapproved, since to a great extent I was now its reluctant victim rather than its willing tool. Yet it was by my own doing that habit had become so potent an enemy, because it was by my own will that I had reached the state in which I no longer wished to stay. Who can justly complain when just punishment overtakes the sinner? I could no longer claim that I had no clear perception of the truth. The excuse that I used to make to myself for postponing my renunciation of the world and my entry into your service. For by now I was quite certain of it. But I was still bound to earth and refused to serve in your army. Instead of fearing, as I ought, to be held back by all that encumbered me, I was frightened to be free of it. In fact, I bore the burden of the world as contentedly as one sometimes bears a heavy load of sleep. My thoughts as I meditated upon you were like the efforts of a man who tries to wake but cannot, and sinks back into the depths of slumber. No one wants to sleep forever, for everyone rightly agrees that it is better to be awake. Yet a man often staves off the effort to rouse himself when his body is leaden with inertia. He is glad to settle down once more, although it is against his better judgment. And it is already time he were up and about. In the same way, I was quite sure it was better for me to give myself up to your love than to surrender to my own lust. But while I wanted to follow the first course and was convinced that it was right, I was still a slave to the pleasures of the second. I had no answer to make when you said, "Awake, you who sleep, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light." You used all the means to prove the truth of your words. And now that I was convinced that they were true, the only answers I could give were the drowsy words of an idler. "Soon, presently, let me wait a little longer." But soon was not soon, and a little longer grew much longer. It was in vain that inwardly I applauded your disposition, when that other disposition in my lower self raised war against the disposition of my conscience, and handed me over as a captive to that disposition towards sin, which my lower self contained. For the rule of sin is the force of habit, by which the mind is swept along and held fast even against its will, yet deservedly, because it fell into the habit of its own accord. Pitiable creature that I was, who was to set me free from a nature thus doomed to death? Nothing else than the grace of God, through Jesus Christ our Lord. 6. O Lord, my helper and my redeemer, I shall now tell and confess to the glory of your name how you released me from the fetters of lust that held me so tightly shackled, and from my slavery to things of this world. I continued to lead my usual life, but I was growing more and more unsettled. And day after day I poured out my heart to you. I went to your church whenever I had time for my work, which was a painful load upon my shoulders. Alypius was with me, now taking respite from his legal work after a third term of office as assessor. He was looking for clients who would pay him for his advice, just as my pupils paid me for skill in words, if it was possible to teach such an art. As a gesture of friendship to Alypius and me, Nebridius had consented to act as assistant to a great friend of ours, named Verecundus, a Milanese who was a teacher of grammar and had made most insistent demands upon our friendship for one of us to give him loyal help, for this he badly needed. It was not the desire of profit that had led Nebridius to accept the post, for if he had wished, he could have earned more by teaching literature. But he was too good and kind a friend to refuse a request that appealed to his good nature. He did what was asked of him in an unobtrusive way, taking care not to attract the attention of important people, as the world reckons importance, in case contact with them should disturb his peace of mind. For for he wanted to keep his mind free and enjoy as many hours of leisure as he could for the purpose of thinking and reading and listening to discussions on philosophy. One day, when for some reason I cannot recall Nebridius was not with us, Alypius and I were visited at our house by a fellow countryman of ours from Africa, a man named Patricianus, who held a high position in the emperor's household. Patricianus had some request to make of us, and we sat down to talk. He happened to notice a book lying on a table used for games, which was near where he was sitting. He picked it up and opened it, and was greatly surprised to find that it contained Paul's epistles, for he had supposed that it was one of the books that used to tax all my strength as a teacher. Then he smiled and looked at me and said how glad he was and how surprised to find this book, and no others, there before my eyes. He, of course, was a Christian and a faithful servant to you, our God. Time and again he knelt before you in church, repeating his prayers and lingering over them. When I told him I had studied Paul's writings with the greatest attention, he began to tell us the story of Antony, the Egyptian monk, whose name was held in high honor by your servants, although Alypius and I had never heard it until then. When Patricianus realized this, he went into greater detail, wishing to instill some knowledge of this great man into our ignorant minds, for he was very surprised that we had not heard of him. For our part, too, we were astonished to hear of the wonders you had worked so recently, almost into our own times, and witnessed by so many in the true faith and the Catholic Church. In fact, all three of us were amazed, Alypius and I because the story we heard was so remarkable, and Patricianus because we had not heard it before. After this, he went on to tell us of the groups of monks in the monasteries, of their way of life that savors your sweetness, and of the fruitful wastes of the desert. All of this was new to us. There was a monastery in Milan also, outside the walls, full of good brethren under the care of Ambrose, but we knew nothing of this either. Patricianus continued to talk, and we listened in silence. Eventually, he told us of the time when he and three of his companions were at Treves. One afternoon, while the emperor was watching the games in the circus, they went out to stroll in the gardens near the city walls. They became separated into two groups, Patricianus and one of the others remaining together while the other two went off by themselves. As they wandered on, the second pair came to a house that was the home of some of your servants, men poor in spirit, to whom the kingdom of heaven belongs. In the house they found a book containing the life of Antony. One of them began to read it, and was so fascinated and thrilled by the story that even before he had finished reading, he conceived the idea of taking upon himself the same kind of life and abandoning his career in the world. Both he and his friend were officials in the service of the state. All at once he was filled with the love of holiness. Angry with himself and full of remorse, he looked at his friend and said, "What do we hope to gain by all the effort we make? What are we looking for? What is our purpose in serving the state? Can we hope for anything better at court than to be the emperor's friends? Even so, surely our position would be precarious and exposed to much danger. We shall meet it at every turn, only to reach another danger that is greater still. And how long is it before we reach it? But if I wish, I could become the friend of God at this very moment." After saying this, he turned back to the book, laboring under the pain of the new life that was taking birth in him. He read on, and in his heart, where you alone could see, a change was taking place. His mind was being divested of the world, as could presently be seen. For while he was reading, his heart leaping and turning in his breast, a cry broke from him as he saw the better course and determined to take it. "Your servant now," he said to his friend, "I have torn myself free from all our ambitions and have decided to serve God. From this moment, here and now, I shall start to serve him. If you will not follow my lead, do not stand in my way." The other answered that he would stand by his comrade, for such service was glorious, and the reward was great. So these two, now your servants, built their tower at the cost that had to be paid, that is, at the cost of giving up all they possessed and following you. At this moment, Ponticianus and the man who had been walking with him in another part of the garden arrived at the house, looking for their friends. Now that they had found them, they said that it was time to go home, as the daylight was beginning to fade. But the other two told them of the decision they had made and what they proposed to do. They explained what had made them decide to take this course and how they had agreed upon it, and they asked their friends, if they would not join them, at least not to put obstacles in their way. Ponticianus said that he and the other man did not change their old ways, but they were moved to tears for their own state of life. In all reverence they congratulated the others and commended themselves to their prayers. Then they went back to the palace, burdened with hearts that were bound to this earth. But the others remained in the house, and their hearts were fixed upon heaven. Both these men were under a promise of marriage, but once the two women heard what had happened, they too dedicated their virginity to you. 7. This is what Ponticianus told us. But while he was speaking, O Lord, you were turning me around to look at myself, for I had placed myself behind my own back, refusing to see myself. You were setting me before my own eyes so I could see how sordid I was, how deformed and squalid, how tainted with ulcers and sores. I saw it all and stood aghast, but there was no place where I could escape from myself. If I tried to turn my eyes away, they fell on Ponticianus, still telling his tale. And in this way you brought me face to face with myself once more, forcing me upon my own sight so that I should see my wickedness and loathe it. I had known it all along, but I had always pretended that it was something different. I had turned a blind eye and forgotten it. But now, the more my heart warmed to those two men as I heard how they had made the choice that was to save them by giving themselves up entirely to your care, the more bitterly I hated myself in comparison with them. Many years of my life had passed, 12 unless I am wrong, since I had read Cicero's Hortensius at the age of 19, and it had inspired me to study philosophy. But I still postponed my renunciation of this world's joys that would have left me free to look for that other happiness, the very search for which, let alone its discovery, I ought to have prized above the discovery of all human treasures and kingdoms, or the ability to enjoy all the pleasures of the body at a mere nod of the head. As a youth I had been woefully at fault, particularly in early adolescence. I had prayed to you for chastity and said, "Give me chastity and continence," but not yet. For I was afraid that you would answer my prayer at once and cure me too soon of the disease of lust that I wanted satisfied, not quelled. I had wandered on along the road of vice and the sacrilegious superstition of the Manichees, not because I thought that it was right, but because I preferred it to the Christian belief that I did not explore as I ought, but opposed simply out of malice. I had pretended to myself that the reason why day after day I staved off the decision to renounce worldly ambition and follow you alone was that I could see no certain goal toward which I might steer my course. But the time had now come when I stood naked before my eyes, while my conscience upbraided me. Am I to be silent? Did you not always say that you would not discard your load of vanity for the sake of the truth that was not proved? Now you know that the truth is proved, but the load is still on your shoulders. Yet here are others who have exchanged their load for wings, although they did not wear themselves out in the search for truth, or spend 10 years or more in making up their minds. All the time that Ponticianus was speaking, my conscience gnawed away at me like this. I was overcome by burning shame, and when he had finished his tale and completed the business for which he had come, he went away, and I was left to my own thoughts. I made all sorts of accusations against myself. I cudgeled my soul and belabored it with reasons why it should follow me now that I was trying so hard to follow you. But it fought back. It would not obey, and yet could offer no excuse. All his old arguments were exhausted, and had been shown to be false. He remained silent and afraid, for as much as the loss of life itself, it feared the staunching of the flow of habit, by which it was wasting away to death. 8. My inner self was a house divided against itself. In the heat of the fierce conflict that I had stirred up against my soul in our common abode, my heart, I turned to Alypius. My looks betrayed the commotion in my mind as I exclaimed, "What is the matter with us? What is the meaning of this story? These men have not had our schooling, and yet they stand up and storm the gates of heaven, while we, for all our learning, lie here, groveling in this world of flesh and blood. Is it because they have led the way that we are ashamed to follow? Is it not worse to hold back?" I can't remember the words I used. I said something to this effect, and then my feelings proved too strong for me. I broke off and turned away, leaving him to gaze at me speechless and astonished, for my voice sounded strange, and the expression of my face and eyes, my flushed cheek, and the pitch of my voice told him more of the state of my mind than the actual words that I spoke. There was a small garden attached to the house where we lodged. We were free to make use of it, as well as the rest of the house, because our host, the owner of the house, did not live there. I now found myself driven by the tumult in my breast to make refuge in this garden, where no one could interrupt that fierce struggle in which I was my own contestant until it came to its conclusion. What the conclusion was to be, you knew, O Lord, but I did not. Meanwhile, I was beside myself with madness that would bring me sanity. I was dying a death that would bring me life. I knew the evil that was in me, but the good that was soon to be born in me, I didn't know. So I went out into the garden, and Alypius followed at my heels. His presence was no intrusion on my solitude, and how could he leave me in that state? We sat down as far as possible from the house. I was frantic, overcome by violent anger with myself for not accepting your will and entering into your covenant. Yet in my bones I knew that this was what I ought to do. In my heart of hearts, I praised it to the skies. And to reach this goal, I needed no chariot or ship. I need not even walk as far as I had come from the house to the place where we sat. For to make the journey and to arrive safely, no more was required than an act of will. But it must be a resolute and wholehearted act of will, not some lame wish that I kept turning over and over in my mind, so that it had to wrestle with itself, part of it trying to rise, and part falling to the ground. During this agony of indecision, I performed many bodily actions, things which a man cannot always do, even if he wills to do them. If he has lost his limbs, or is bound hand and foot, or if his body is weakened by illness or under some other handicap, there are things which he cannot do. I tore my hair and hammered my forehead with my fists. I locked my fingers and hugged my knees. I did all this because I made an act of will to do it. But I might have had the will to do it and yet not have done it if my limbs had been unable to move in compliance with my will. I performed all these actions in which the will and power to act are not the same. Yet I did not do that one thing that I should have been far, far better pleased to do than all the rest, and could have done it once, as soon as I had the will to do it, because as soon as I had the will to do it, I should have willed it wholeheartedly. For in this case the power to act was the same as the will. To will it was to do it, yet I did not do it. My body responded to the slightest wish of my mind by moving its limbs at least a hint from me, and it did so more readily than my mind obeyed itself by assenting to its own great desire that could be accomplished simply by an act of will. 9. Why does this strange phenomenon occur? What causes it? O Lord, in your mercy give me light to see, for it may be that the answer to my question lies in the secret punishment of man, and in the penitence that casts a deep shadow on the sons of Adam. Why does this strange phenomenon occur? What causes it? The mind gives an order to the body, and is once obeyed. But when it gives an order to itself, it is resisted. The mind commands the hand to move, and is so readily obeyed that the order can scarcely be distinguished from its execution. Yet the mind is mind, and the hand is part of the body. But when the mind commands the mind to make an act of will, these two are one and the same, and yet the order is not obeyed. Why does this happen? What's the cause of it? The mind orders itself to make an act of will, and it would not give this order unless it willed to do so. Yet it does not carry out its own command. But it does not fully will to do this thing, and therefore its orders are not fully given. It gives orders only in so far as it wills, and in so far as it does not will, the order is not carried out. For the will commands that an act of will should be made, and it gives this command to itself, not to some other will. The reason, then, why the command is not obeyed is that it is not given with the full will. If the will were full, it would not command itself to be full, since it would be already. It is therefore no strange phenomenon, partly to will to do something, and partly to will not to do it. It is a disease of the mind that does not wholly rise to the heights where it is lifted by the truth, because it is weighed down by habit. So there are two wills in us, because neither by itself is the whole will, and each possesses what the other lacks. 10. There are many abroad who talk of their own fantasies and lead men's minds astray. They assert that because they have observed that there are two wills at odds with each other when we try to reach a decision, we must therefore have two minds of a different nature, one good and the other evil. Let them vanish at God's presence as the smoke vanishes. As long as they hold these evil beliefs, they are evil themselves. But even they will be good if they see the truth and accept it, so that your apostle may say to them, "Once you were all darkness, now in the Lord you are all daylight." These people want to be light, not in the Lord, but in themselves, because they think that the nature of the soul is the same as God. In this way their darkness becomes denser still, because in their abominable ignorance they have separated themselves still further from you, who are the true light that enlightens every soul born into the world. I say to them, take care what you say, and blush for shame. Enter God's presence and find there enlightenment. Here is no room for downcast looks. When I was trying to reach a decision about serving the Lord my God, as I had long intended to do, it was I who willed to take this course. And again, it was I who willed not to take it. It was I and I alone, but I neither willed to do it nor refused to do it with my full will. So I was at odds with myself. I was throwing myself into confusion. All this happened to me, although I did not want it, but it did not prove that there was some second mind in me besides my own. It only meant that my mind was being punished. My action did not come from me, but from the sinful principle that dwells in me. It was part of the punishment of a sin freely committed by Adam, my first father. If there were as many different natures in us as there are conflicting wills, we should have a great many more natures than merely two. Suppose that someone is trying to decide whether to go to the theater or to the Manichees meeting house. The Manichees will say, clearly he has two natures, the good one bringing him here to us, and the bad one leading him away. Otherwise, how can you explain this dilemma of two opposing wills? I say that the will to attend their meetings is just as bad as the will to go off to the theater, but in their opinion it can only be a good will that leads a man to come to them. Suppose, then, that one of us is wavering between two conflicting wills and cannot make up his mind whether to go to the theater or to our church. Will not the Manichees be embarrassed to know what to say? Either they must admit, which they will not do, that it is a good will that brings a man to our church, just as in their opinion it is a good will that brings their own communicants and adherents to their church, or they must presume that there are two evil natures and two evil minds in conflict in one man. If they think this, they will disprove their own theory that there is one good and one evil will in man. The only alternative is for them to be converted to the truth and to cease to deny that when a man tries to make a decision, he has one soul that is torn between conflicting wills. So let us hear no more of their assertion, when they observe two wills in conflict in one man, that there are two opposing minds in him, one good and the other bad, and that they are in conflict because they spring from two opposing substances and two opposing principles. For you, O God of truth, prove that they are utterly wrong. You demolish their arguments and confound them completely. It may be that both the wills are bad. For instance, a man may be trying to decide whether to commit murder by poison or by stabbing, whether he should swindle another man out of one part of his property or another, that is, if he cannot obtain both, whether he should spend his money extravagantly on pleasure or hoard it like a miser, or whether he should go to the games in the circus or to the theater, when there is a performance at both places on the same day. In the last case, there may be a third possibility that he should go and rob another person's house if he has the chance. There may even be a fourth choice open to him because he may wonder whether to go and commit adultery if the occasion arises at the same time. These possibilities may all occur at the same moment, and all may seem equally desirable. The man cannot do all these things at once, and his mind is torn between four wills that cannot be reconciled, perhaps more than four, because there are a great many things that he might wish to do. But the Manichees do not claim that there are as many different substances in us as this. It is just the same when wills are good. If I question the Manichees whether it is good to find pleasure in reading Paul's epistles, or in the tranquil enjoyment of a psalm, or in a discussion of the gospel, they will reply in each case that it is good. Supposing then that a man finds all these things equally attractive, and the chance to do all of them occurs at the same time, is it not true that as long as he cannot make up his mind which of them he most wants to do, his heart is torn between several desires? All these different desires are good, and yet they are in conflict with each other until he chooses a single course to which the will may apply itself as a single whole, so that it is no longer split into several different wills. The same is true when the higher part of our nature aspires after eternal bliss, while our lower self is held back by the love of temporal pleasure. It is the same soul that wills both, but it wills neither of them with the full force of the will. So it is wrenched into two and suffers great trials, because while truth teaches it to prefer one course, habit prevents it from relinquishing the other. 11. This was the nature of my sickness. I was in torment, reproaching myself more bitterly than ever as I twisted and turned in my chain. I hoped that my chain might be broken once and for all, because it was only a small thing that held me now. All the same, it held. And you, O Lord, never ceased to watch over my secret heart. In your stern mercy you lashed me with the twin scourge of fear and shame, in case I should give way once more, and the worn and slender remnant of my chain should not be broken, but gain new strength and bind me all the faster. In my heart I kept saying, "Let it be now, let it be now." And merely by saying this, I was on the point of making the resolution. I was on the point of making it, but I didn't succeed. Yet I didn't fall back into my old state, either. I stood on the brink of resolution, waiting to take fresh breath. I tried again, and came a little nearer to my goal, and then a little nearer still, so that I could almost reach out and grasp it. But I didn't reach it. I couldn't reach out to grasp it, because I held back from the step by which I should die to death and become alive to life. My lower instincts, that had taken firm hold of me, were stronger than the higher, that were untried. And the closer I came to the moment that was to mark the great change in me, the more I shrank from it in horror. But it did not drive me back or turn me from my purpose. It merely left me hanging in suspense. I was held back by mere trifles, the most paltry inanities, all my old attachments. They plucked at my garment of flesh and whispered, "Are you going to dismiss us? From this moment, we shall never be with you again, forever and ever. From this moment, you will never again be allowed to do this thing or that, forevermore." What was it, my God, that they meant when they whispered, "This thing or that"? Things so sordid and so shameful that I beg you in your mercy to keep the soul of your servant free from them. These voices, as I heard them, seemed less than half as loud as they had been before. They no longer barred my way, blatantly contradictory, but their muttering seemed to reach me from behind, as though they were stealthily plucking at my back, trying to make me turn my head when I wanted to go forward. Yet in my state of indecision, they kept me from tearing myself away, from shaking myself free of them, and leaping across the barrier to the other side, where you were calling me. Habit was too strong for me when it asked, "Do you think you can live without these things?" But by now the voice of habit was very faint. I had turned my eyes elsewhere, and while I stood trembling at the barrier, on the other side I could see the chaste beauty of countenance in all her serene, unsullied joy, as she modestly beckoned me to cross over and hesitate no more. She stretched out loving hands to welcome and embrace me, holding up a host of good examples to my sight. With her were countless boys and girls, great numbers of young and people of all ages, staid widows and women still virgins in old age. And in their midst was Continence herself, not barren but a fruitful mother of children, of joys born of you, O Lord, her spouse. She smiled at me to give me courage, as though she were saying, "Can you not do what these men and women have done? Do you think they find strength to do it in themselves and not in the Lord their God? It was the Lord their God who gave me to them. Why do you try to stand in your own strength and fail? Cast yourself upon God and have no fear. He will not shrink away and let you fall. Cast yourself upon him without fear, for he will welcome you and cure you of your ills." I was overcome with shame, because I was still listening to the futile mutterings of my lower self, and I was still hanging in suspense. And again Continence seemed to say, "Close your ears to the unclean whispers of your body, so that it may be mortified. It tells you of things that delight you, but not such things as the law of the Lord your God has to tell." In this way I wrangled with myself in my own heart, about my own self, and all the while Alypius stayed at my side, silently awaiting the outcome of this agitation that was new in me. 12. I probed the hidden depths of my soul and wrung its pitiful secrets from it, and when I mustered them all before the eyes of my heart, a great storm broke within me, bringing with it a great deluge of tears. I stood up and left Alypius so that I might weep and cry to my heart's content, for it occurred to me that tears were best shed in solitude. I moved away far enough to avoid being embarrassed even by his presence. He must have realized what my feelings were, for I suppose I had said something, and he had known from the sound of my voice that I was ready to burst into tears. So I stood up and left him where he had been sitting, utterly bewildered. Somehow I flung myself down beneath a fig tree and gave way to the tears that now streamed from my eyes, the sacrifice that is acceptable to you. I had much to say to you, my God, not in these very words, but in this strain. Lord, will you never be content? Must we always taste your vengeance? Forget the long record of our sins. For I felt that I was still the captive of my sins, and in my misery I kept crying, "How long shall I go on saying tomorrow and tomorrow? Why not now? Why not make an end of my ugly sins at this moment?" I was asking myself these questions, weeping all the while with the most bitter sorrow in my heart, when all at once I heard the sing-song voice of a child in a nearby house. Whether it was the voice of a boy or a girl, I can't say, but Again and again, I repeated the refrain, "Take it and read, take it and read." At this, I looked up, thinking hard whether there was any kind of game in which children used to chant words like this, but I couldn't remember ever hearing them before. I stemmed my flood of tears and stood up, telling myself that this could only be a divine command to open my book of Scripture and read the first passage on which my eyes should fall. For I had heard the story of Antony and remembered how he had happened to go into a church while the gospel was being read and had taken it as a counsel addressed to himself when he heard the words, "Go home and sell all that belongs to you. Give it to the poor, and so the treasure you have shall be in heaven. Then come back and follow me." By this divine pronouncement, he had at once been converted to you. So I hurried back to the place where Alypius was sitting, for when I stood up to move away, I had put down the book containing Paul's epistles. I seized it and opened it, and in silence I read the first passage on which my eyes fell. "Not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lust and wantonness, not in quarrels and rivalries. Rather, arm yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. Spend no more thought on nature and nature's appetites." I had no wish to read more, and no need to do so. For, in an instant as I came to the end of the sentence, it was as though the light of confidence flooded into my heart, and all the darkness of doubt was dispelled. I marked the place with my finger, or by some other sign, and closed the book. My looks now were quite calm as I told Alypius what had happened to me. He too told me what he had been feeling, which of course I did not know. He asked to see what I had read. I showed it to him, and he read on beyond the text that I had read. I did not know what followed, but it was this: "Find room among you for a man of over-delicate conscience." Alypius applied this to himself and told me so. This admonition was enough to give him strength, and without suffering the distress of hesitation, he made his resolution and took good purpose to himself. And it very well suited his moral character, that had long been far, far better than my own. Then we went in and told my mother, who was overjoyed, and when we went on to describe how it had all happened, she was jubilant with triumph and glorified you, who are powerful enough and more than powerful enough to carry out your purpose beyond all our hopes and dreams. For she saw that you had granted her far more than she used to ask in her tearful prayers and plaintive lamentations. You converted me to yourself, so that I no longer desired a wife or placed any hope in this world, but stood firmly upon the rule of faith, where you had shown me to her in a dream so many years before, and you turned her sadness into rejoicing, into joy far fuller than her dearest wish, far sweeter and more chaste than any she had hoped to find in children begotten of my flesh. End of Book 8. Book 9. 1. Lord, I am your servant, born of your handmaid. You have broken the chains that bound me. I will sacrifice in your honor. Let me praise you in my heart. Let me praise you with my tongue. Let this be the cry of my whole being. Lord, there is none like you. Let them say this, and in answer, I beg you to whisper in my heart, I am here to save you. Who am I? What kind of man am I? What evil have I not done? Or if there is evil that I have not done, what evil is there that I have not spoken? If there is any I have not spoken, what evil is there that I have not willed to do? But you, O Lord, are good. You are merciful. You saw how deeply I was sunk into death, and it was your power that drained dry the well of corruption in the depths of my heart. And all that you asked of me was to deny my own will and accept yours. But during all those years, where was my free will? What was the secret hidden place from which it was summoned in a moment, so that I might bend my neck to your easy yoke and take my light burden upon your shoulders, Christ Jesus, my helper and redeemer. How sweet all at once it was for me to be rid of those fruitless joys that I had once feared to lose and was now glad to reject. You drove them from me, you who are the true sovereign joy. You drove them from me and took their place, you who are sweeter than all pleasure, though not of flesh and blood. You who outshine all light, yet are hidden deeper than any secret in our hearts. You who surpass all honor, though not in the eyes of men who see all honor in themselves. At last my mind was free from the gnawing anxieties of ambition and gain, from wallowing in filth and scratching the itching sore of lust. I began to talk to you freely, O Lord my God, my light, my wealth, and my salvation.